curious about gastronomy, food practices and cultures and food studies. Our interview today is with Julia Possenby. Julia is a cook and currently works at Schumacher School in England. Julia is the author of several cookbooks and talk about the influence of Eastern view on cooking. Julia has a holistic view of eating and cooking, which involves vegetarianism, sustainability, mindful and slow food practice. This interview was translated into Portuguese by English students at Federal Institute of Brasília, Riacho Fundo Campus. Let's go!
Thank you, Julia, for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's start talking about your professional life. When did you start cooking?
Well, I started cooking very young because I loved cooking and all my family enjoyed cooking. My father always enjoyed cooking, and you know, grandparents and my mother, and we had a lady who was our cleaner, and she always used to make cakes. So I used to be allowed to grease the cake pans with butter. So that was my first memory of making cakes, and I make lots of cakes now, as you realize. So I started cooking very young, but it was only when I was about 20, my mother's friends and my relations started to ask me to cater professionally for events. So, you know, it might be somebody's 75th birthday party and I would go to their house and I cook for them, or it might be the launch of I remember there was this Italian group in Florence. It was a music festival and I was asked to cater for them because their agent was in London and they were coming to her house. So I had to cook food and take it there and serve it up. And then, you know, other kitchen showrooms, or these different events that I started to be asked to cater for because I'd got a reputation as a good cook. So that was my first experience of doing professional catering. And then I really wasn't imagining being a cook, but people kept asking me to. And then I came to Schumacher College because I was interested in environmental politics, and I was in the Green Party. And when I was here, I was sort of amazed by the food because it's, you know, really good vegetarian cooking. And then I met Stefan, so my husband, who's a teacher here, and then I came back, and then quickly the chef here discovered that I was a good cook and asked me to cook here. So I started cooking the weekend food. So that's really how I began.
When was that?
That's
how
like
how old were you?
I was like 31. This is a long time ago.
Okay.
So this is back in the beginning of Schumacher College.
Great.
This is like 1991. It's a long time ago.
Okay.
And so then I made the weekend food at the college on a Friday, and then the chef, when the chef left, then they needed to find a new chef. So this is only after a couple of years. The chef, Helen Challoner, left. She actually went to work up at Dartington Hall. And so they were looking for a new chef. And I thought, well, I didn't really know. I didn't want to make my whole life being a chef. But then I thought, well, here it's really different. At Schumacher College, you work with really interesting people and a variety of people. And it's like you're doing kind of home cooking, but you're sharing with it. So I really enjoyed the way of cooking at Schumacher College. I'd been on a course already, so I might have forgotten to say that. So I came on the first course at Schumacher College, the Gaia Theory with James Lovelock. So that was 5 weeks long. In those days, all the courses were 5 weeks long when there were no master's program. So anyway, so I really enjoyed that experience. And so when they couldn't immediately get a replacement for Helen Challoner when she left, I said, well, I wouldn't mind doing it for a year. But now, you see, I've been here for much longer than a year. But I did take...
Almost, 30 years?
Yes, but not all the time. Because when my son Oscar was born, he's 18 years old now, I actually stopped doing my job for about 3 years.
Okay.
And I still lived here, so I could still make the occasional cake, and I did some rotas for the volunteers. So I was still involved in community life, but I wasn't the chef then. I wasn't in charge of the cooking. And Wayne Schroeder, joined, and he was with us for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came back to work, we kind of shared the job together.
And so talking about Schumacher, the kitchen, at least to me, it seems to be the heart of the college here. Mm-hmm. And it's a chance to put head, heart and hands methodology into practice. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, people often say that. And I think it must be true because people say that so much.
Mm.
And people seem really happy in the kitchen. Almost always people seem happy and creative in the kitchen. And also now we have so much garden produce coming in. It's even more this sort of walking your talk part of the kitchen, because you're transforming a whole load of potatoes or beetroots or onions or whatever into a delicious meal. So you're doing that with the people who are here to study with their head as well, and you're nurturing the rest of the people, so it's a very fulfilling role.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people seem to come, sometimes you get people who've come and they say, oh, can I just help in the kitchen? So it does seem to be, I hope it's one of the hearts of the kitchen, of the community, and quite resilient, I think.
Mm.
Our kitchen, you know, because we had to move out of the old postern, and then we had to cater in the chicken shed for 2 weeks, went and bought some induction hobs, and then we went up the hill. We had to send food down, like Meals on Wheels, for 6 months. And now we're in the porter cabin.
Mm.
And now we have to take the food down the sort of dark ramp in the dark, in the cold and the rain, and put it on the table. But still, the food's never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps coming, and people still say they really enjoy the food.
Yeah.
And people always bring new ideas. So I feel that it's always reinvigorated, the cooking here. So that's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas from all over the world, and ideas about nutrition, cooking styles. And
how
everything.
Do you incorporate those ideas? Because there are people here from all around the world.
Yeah.
And some of the recipes that we wrote incorporate this variety of culture. And how does it change the way you do the cooking or the life in the kitchen?
Yeah, I think it's that we do have a very varied menu plan, and we've always had that. So you know, you've got sometimes food's quite spicy or quite plain, sometimes it's got beans, sometimes it's mainly vegetables, sometimes it's vegan, sometimes it's got dairy and eggs in it. So it's quite varied already, and lots of people who come here aren't vegetarian anyway, so you have to make sure they are satisfied. So we're trying to cater for a variety of tastes. And then the other thing that we have to be prepared to do is have a special diet table. So if you get people who can't really, like we got this man from Myanmar, this 3 week course, and he can only eat rice and eggs with sunflower oil on. He doesn't like olive oil. So then, you know, that comes to my attention that he may not be happy because he doesn't like the food. And so then we're now making sure he gets eggs and rice every meal, so he's happy. So you have to kind of make these little adjustments as you go along. In fact, I must go and make sure Seamus knows about making 2 eggs for him. So, and then the other thing is offering up Sunday as an opportunity for people to cook their own food. So in the last 2 Sundays, we've had people in the learning community cooking Japanese, Korean and Chinese food. And we've had Chinese New Year being celebrated here. And also people will come at different times and kind of cook their own thing. Like Joyu, she often comes and makes dumplings or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to, you're making the regular meals, you know, lunch and supper, but you also have to allow the kitchen to be a bit more open for people to do their own bit of catering outside times.
Mm-hmm.
And take over the menu every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how we cater. And then, of course, if people really want meat, they have to just go to the local pub. But it doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of belonging to nature, to Gaia, here, is very important. How does it relate to growing food and cooking at Schumacher College?
Yeah, of belonging. Well, I don't know. I think because you're eating food from the land, then it's kind of really embedding you in that land, especially because you're every course here, not just the growers who are dedicated to the growing, but every short course or postgraduate course will go out in the field and get involved with harvesting and planting things and weeding and everything. So you have the kind of excitement of actually seeing things grow. And I think that really makes people feel very sort of a personal connection with it. So that's one way people feel more bonded with the land. And they understand the whole way that you have, you know, food miles and the carbon footprint and how that's reduced by having a more local diet, that again makes people feel more bonded. And you get a sense of the seasons. So Gaia operates with seasons. So when you work in the garden and you cook mainly seasonal food, that helps you tune in to Gaia's dance, if you like, which is the dance of the seasons. So I think that's really, really important. And I hope it gives people a sense of belonging, because often people aren't here very long. But because they're here and they're working in the garden and they're cooking with a lot of garden produce, I think it helps to speed up that sense of belonging.
We have the garden here, and we also have the compost, the process. Yeah. How was it created?
Well, at the beginning of the college, I came on the first course, and no one knew that Schumacher College was going to be so successful. It was at the very beginning. It was still an experiment. And we all learned permaculture. We had teachers coming in and teaching us about permaculture. And we had composting. So right from the beginning, we had a compost heap and composting. But we didn't grow vegetables. So we didn't really have the we didn't have the system of growing our own vegetables at that point. We would have a short course and we might do a bit of gardening, but then it would end and people would go away and there wouldn't be any sustained gardening. So it took a long time before an actual gardening program got established. I would say it was actually inspired by one of the holistic science students, Justin. So probably about almost 15 years, so half the lifetime of the college, when Karen Blinko became the director of the college, Justin had been working with Martin Crawford in the Forest Garden, and he wanted to make his dissertation and write his dissertation on forest gardening and how to bring forest gardening onto the Schumacher campus, this particular bit of gardening. So up till then, we had to move out of the college for 5 weeks every summer, and the Summer School of Music would move into the Schumacher buildings. And that was always put as a kind of one reason why we can't do our own gardening. And so we had these contract gardeners coming down, trimming the hedges, mowing the lawn, and we only had this very intermittent gardening. And some of the teachers, like Fritjof Capra, you know, author of Tao of Physics, he always said that it's a real lack that we don't have a more sustained garden here, because in his project, Eco-Literacy project that he used to run, they saw the garden as a major learning tool. So he was very happy when it began to evolve. So first of all, it evolved in terms of Justin planting lots of trees around, even on the lawn. And then Julie Richards, another graduate of the holistic science course, she had again based on her dissertation, had a vision called Landscope, and it was for using all the set aside bits of land on the Dartington estate for different projects. And then she saw the potential of the work Justin had done, and she made a link with a local agricultural college, I think, the Duchy College, the one that Prince Charles sponsors. And so they came onto the estate, and it was based in the chicken shed, and they started teaching a horticulture course. And then they used the Schumacher garden as part of their learning. And so from that point onwards, there was vegetable growing and gardening, but it wasn't as useful as it was now. I mean, they might grow some kind of unusual grain or something that would be very difficult for the cooks to manage. But that began to manifest that we had more growing happening and maybe some winter salad and all that. So that happened. And then when John Ray came, he said, we need a resident gardener. So we had some different people already before that in charge of the garden. And we had this teaching program allied with the college. But then Jane Gleason arrived and she became a kind of a resident gardener. So Justin had left by then. So long before then. And then we had another gardener before her called Jane Pickard, who created that garden over there. Jane created Henry's Field. So all the time, the amount of produce being produced was going up and up and up. Mm-hmm. And to this point now where we're getting really high quality, useful vegetables that we can use. And that means we don't have to buy so many products from Riverford, so much produce from Riverford. Mm-hmm. So it's really made a big difference. But it took a long time to get there. You know, for a long time, people would be growing things that were useful to show students how to grow. These Dutchie or Bicton horticulture students who were doing their sort of practical course. So they would learn to grow things which weren't that useful to us in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But since Jane's been involved, they've just been growing more and more, you know, carrots, potatoes, beetroots. At one point, the gardeners would say to us, well, there's no point in us growing carrots because it will take up so much room and you can just get them from Riverford anyway. So we want to grow the more special things that we, not the kind of basics like potatoes. But now, since they've got this big Henry's Field, they've been consciously trying to grow as much for the Schumacher College, that so we don't have to buy those things. So the gardeners decided that to do that, and they asked me, you know, can you show me all your orders so we can see how much you get from Riverford, so we can see if we can produce that much. And to begin with, the produce was like potatoes with holes in, you know, where the slugs had eaten them, or they get potato blight and they'd have to cut all the rot off them. Mm-hmm. So the produce wasn't so great. It would be very labour intensive to clean it and chop the bits off. But just gradually, it's just got better and, you know, better, better quality. Now it's equal standard to Riverford Farm. Mm-hmm. So that's how it's been. It's been a kind of slow but gradual process.
Mm-hmm. And the composting developing at the same point.
Developed composting, and we had compost heaps before then. What we didn't have was the Rydan. So the Rydan arrived with someone called Bethan, who was the first gardener who was employed after Justin left. So she was employed to teach, and she knew about Rydans. So before we had the Rydan, we had a problem with rats, because the rats love the nice warm compost heap, and they would make nests in it, and they would have little baby rats. And then you'd send some kind of old lady to do the compost in the compost heap, and they'd sort of freak out because there would be lots of little rats in the compost heap.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a very good situation. So Bethan got the Rydan. Rydan is like, Thomas the Tank Engine, and it has an auger, a big screw going up the middle, and a handle that you crank round. Mm-hmm. So the old leftovers and some wood chip pellets go up the middle, and after 2 weeks come out the other end. Now, it's not complete compost by that point, but it's ready to go into the compost bays and for its next stage. And by the point it comes out of the Rydan, it's no longer interesting to rats. So it solved the rat problem.
Right.
So that's very good. And the Rydan was invented by two men, Richard and Dan. So they put their names together, Richard, R-I, and then Dan, Rydan. And you have these Rydan machines in lots of primary schools. They're very useful machines. They come in all different sizes.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot more being compost. But right from the beginning, people have been eating food, mainly organic, and so it's been going into the compost. But because we put together all sorts into our compost, cooked food, and raw food and dairy all goes together, that's what attracts the rats. So it's very difficult to get a separation system going with your compost, which is what you'd need to do if you didn't want to attract rats. And I think we have had wormeries. I'm not sure if we've got one at the minute, but maybe there's a wormery. I think that Marguerite or Lina mentioned a wormery.
About the books you have written, 4 books on vegetarian recipes, mindfulness and cooking. How did the idea of writing and sharing the recipes create that the college come
so,
up?
Yes. Well, you know, really early on, before I took over the running the kitchen, after a couple of years, I think, I can't actually remember, maybe it was after 4 years, but I was already working there. So my predecessor, Helen Challoner, people were saying, oh, we love the food here. You should make a recipe book. People say, you should make a recipe book. And you know, there was this Green Books is a publishing company that was formed with Satish and John Elford. And it moved from where Satish lives in North Devon to Totnes and on the Dartington estate. It used to be based at Foxhole, that big white building. So we had this publishing company. And so the idea, and one of the trustees, John Lane, who's no longer with us, sadly, but he was very keen on this idea of a cookbook. So my colleague, Helen Challoner, started to gather recipe books. But the problem was that none of the recipes were original. So all the recipes were taken from other books. And she'd been at the Zen Center before, so she'd had experience some really good vegetarian cooking, you know, like from Ed Brown, Tassajara Cookbook, Molly Katzin, Enchanted Broccoli Forest, and the Moosewood Cookbook. So all those recipes were on recipe cards and being used at Schumacher College with our teams of students who will get involved in the cooking. But so when I took over, the recipe book idea was still there. I always wrote, so I've always liked writing. So I was very keen to make this idea happen. And if the problem is that we don't have enough original recipes, but by then we already had recipes that people had come and said, you know, and that's an amazing recipe. They cooked it on a Sunday. And I said, well, can you leave us the recipe? So we already were beginning to build up some original recipes. And then I had my own recipes, which I would write down, and other chefs brought recipes. And then, so then we had a whole mixture of recipes, and I began to put them down and create this cookbook. And I thought, well, if people aren't going to be behind it, because some people would say, oh, my school produced a recipe and book and no one, you know, bought it. And it was, you know, people could say negative things about, you know, how everyone does recipe books and not such a great thing to do. But I thought, well, because people keep asking for a recipe book, I'll just write it and then I can just print it out and give it to people, you know, just as a little booklet. So I thought it shouldn't be an obstacle not to do it. So I started working on it, and then by the end I had a, you know, proper book. And then I went to the publisher, John Elford, and he was interested in it. So he told our director, Anne Phillips. And then at the same time, some money came in. I think there was a donation of money from somebody, and very generous. So that could be security. So if the project didn't make any money and Dartington lost money on it, that money would be there as a security. So that all came together. So Anne Phillips really supported the recipe book from that point onwards. The publishing company really wanted to print it, and I, you know, I was keen on writing it. So once we got everybody keen on it, then it was just a matter of fine-tuning it, you know, editing it down to the right size, appointing a designer, deciding on the format, you know, appointing a photographer. I had a sculptress called Antonia Spowers, who was here as a volunteer, and I asked her to draw vegetables in her spare time as a volunteer slot. So you'll see that in Gaia's kitchens, there's lots of lovely drawings of vegetables. So that's how the first book came together. Mm. So that was really nice. And then what I did was some of the recipes that were real favourites, like cheese and nut roast, which was from Ed Brown's Tassajara Cookbook, or broccoli and tofu with spicy peanut sauce from Molly Katzen's Enchanted Broccoli Forest. I wrote to them and I said, can we use your recipe in our cookbook? And we acknowledge you. And they were all happy to for us to use it. So then, you know, it's not you're not stealing anyone's recipes. You're acknowledging that it's their recipe. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got around that problem. Mm-hmm. So I tried to make sure every recipe's got a little story with it about where it came from.
There is a recipe in Gaia's Feast of the Brazilian cheese bread.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Pão de Queijo.
Yeah.
That's right. That was interesting because, yeah, so I actually got the first time I got that recipe, it was from an English woman who'd been in Brazil. So she gave me this and I thought, wow, this is really delicious. I love these. And so I made it from that. And then when I made the recipe for the cookbook, I don't think it, then it suddenly didn't always work. And then there was another Brazilian, I think I mentioned it in the cookbook, and she said, oh no, you should use my grandmother's recipe. So she gave me another recipe. So in the end, I just had like tested both of them and just got something that would be foolproof. You always try and make the recipes foolproof so anyone can cook them. So, yeah. And then we try and get hold of the tapioca flour. It's not always easy.
Yeah. In this Gaia kitchen, you mentioned how you select the ingredients to cook here in Schumacher College. Can you tell us a little bit about it? How do you choose the ingredients? How do you get them?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have a whole philosophy of cooking and eating. And so part of how we choose our ingredients is kind of guided by that. So we want to have whole food and organic food. If you've got organic whole food, then you can eat the skin on the nut, the skin on the apple, the skin on the potato, and you've got lots of nutrients just below the skin there. So you can use the whole of the ingredient. So we want to do whole food cooking. Another thing is if you're buying whole food, you can get big sacks of things. I can buy sort of 25 kg of rice or beans or something like that. So you're reducing packaging. So another influence is to reduce our carbon footprint. So so we're having whole food, we're reducing our carbon footprint. We're vegetarian, so we're not buying in any meat or fish. We are we do have cheese and dairy, and Devon is an area where there's lots of dairy produce. So we try and get organic cheese where we can. And mostly all the cheddar cheese is organic and locally made, and quite a lot of it's like made with Sharpham cheeses from the herd there, which I think is a biodynamic herd. So it's mostly, and the milk is organic. At the beginning, I couldn't get organic milk, but a few years on, then the Riverford Milk Dairy started up, so I could get organic milk. So those are some of the key things. And I always try and introduce people to the philosophy of our food at the beginning of every course, so they'll understand, you know, whole food, organic, vegetarian, you think what else? Fairly traded. So another thing is we could have a completely local diet, but it would be very, very limited in certain seasons, not in the summer, but it would be very limited in the sort of what we call the hungry gap in, say, February and March, when you can't get very much growing from the land and the stores begin to run out. And so that's one thing. And the other thing is we have a very international group of people here, and some of them don't come very long. So we want them to settle into the diet quite quickly, and it can take a while to adapt to a new diet. So for that reason, this is my argument for keeping things like bananas and rice. This rice isn't a local product, still on the menu here. So we're very varied in our diet, but we do give preference to local food and fairly traded if it is coming from abroad, and preferably not flown in. So we'd get bananas, which would be shipped in by Riverford, and they'd be fairly traded and organic. And then we say to people, if you feel your conscience is pricked by eating a banana, then just don't eat it, and then we can order less. But actually, when we had, I think, 2 years when we didn't have any bananas at all, in the fruit bowl, and but then we had an apple harvest failure, and the cost of apples went up, and it was higher than bananas. Mm-hmm. So I started getting bananas again, and I haven't had anyone really complaining about it then. But during the time we didn't have bananas, people used to go and buy their own bananas from the village shop. Mm-hmm. So I thought, people seem to really feel bananas are kind of comfort food or something. So, yeah, so those are some of the main things. But now, of course, one of the main influences wanting to use garden produce. So when I make the menu plans with my colleagues, Ruth and Sarah, I look at the list from the garden and they say, give me an estimate. They send me a list. Marguerite or Lena, the interns, will compile the weekly list, and it will say, you know, beetroot 3 kg or leeks plenty, and so go through the list of everything they've got in the garden, and then we prioritize putting those into our menu plans.
What's the importance of the Eastern contributions?
Well, I mean, with a lot of those Eastern influences, you get a real endorsement of vegetarian diets and mindfulness as well. So I think they contribute a lot. And lots more people are becoming vegan now as people become aware of the sort of underbelly of the agribusiness and the whole dairy industry. There's been a lot of triggers which have influenced people to want to give up dairy now. And it's a lot to do with the way the agribusiness and the dairy industry functions when it's on an industrial level. So, for example, at Plum Village, the Thai Buddhist centre in France, they are all vegan there. And we had some people coming from Plum Village, and they wanted to do Vegan Week while it was the Paris Climate Conference. So to have mainly vegan food. And so it's quite, I don't know if I fully understand the whole way that you could look at veganism and diet, but apparently the people who argue about it, and we often have very, very committed vegans at the college who will make it into an issue, a discussion point, that even if you fly in your protein, you know, nuts from the other side of the world, it's going to use less emit less carbon than if you are eating a local meat-based diet. But you know, I haven't looked at all those details myself. I think it's quite complex. Mm-hmm. But we have had holistic science students writing about that before. Mm-hmm. For their dissertations. Yeah, so it's very interesting. Terry and Marika, they were two vegans who were here. So I think that's one important aspect. But I'm not at this point, I'm not thinking the college ought to become vegan, because we've got all this dairy in Devon, and we favour organic farming. So that means you're going for a more humane form of production anyway. We're not getting sort of, because in the Soil Association, which is the governing body for organic farming, they have very strict animal welfare standards. So you can be sure if you're serving things which are organic, you're not going to be getting kind of really big industrial farming products, which is where the real problem comes, that makes you think, you know, you need to be vegan to ensure that animals have a good life. So then the mindfulness was the other thing. So I think you don't want to get caught up in that whole rush of life that makes, in the end, makes life not a very pleasant thing to engage in, and makes our lives full of stress. And maybe those, when if you're mass producing food, maybe some of that stress goes into it. Certainly with something like, if you were eating meat, you know that there are stress hormones that animals emit into their bodies when they're taken to the slaughterhouse. and then if you eat that meat, that kind of stress will go into your body. And it could be that there's some other kind of stress that might be in the mass production of other food, where people are working under stress and handling vegetables. I mean, maybe this is a bit unproven, but it seems to me like many of these things might go together. So if rather you're having a quality of life and you're enjoying producing food, you're enjoying cooking food, you're not you're doing it in a kind of gentle way. I mean, not, and within, you could take that idea too far. You could just be so slow that you'd never get the food on the table in time. But I think there's a kind of happy medium where people can be mindful in their production of food, enjoy the process. They're less likely to cut their finger or feel stress. And then the joy of that is a bit like, you know, that book, Water for Chocolate, where all the emotions of the chef go into everything she cooks. So when she's cooking her sister's wedding cake and her sister's marrying her beloved, she's so upset that she cries into the wedding cake, and then everyone at the feast starts crying, at the wedding feast starts crying. So sometimes I think maybe it's a bit like that you put some of your emotion or your quality into the food you cook. And that's one reason I think I love the way that we work at Schumacher College, because we're not like got one team of chefs who produce all the meals and get a bit bored of doing it. We constantly have new teams of people coming, and they sort of reinvigorate the process of cooking, and they enjoy doing it. And so I think it's nice that we involve different people with cooking all the time.
So we do have a lot of bread here, and you wrote about baking and hearthing. What's the importance of baking in the history of food?
Especially in maybe Western food, I think bread is is based on grains, but maybe coming from, would it be Egypt? I'm not sure, maybe. But that discovery of fermentation and using the natural yeasts from the environment that come into the bread, it's got a huge history, hasn't it, in terms of discovering the growing fields of wheat and moving from being hunters and gatherers to being a population who had fields of wheat and barley and all these grains. So that must have come at the same time when people stopped being hunters and gatherers and started being more sedentary. That must have been when people also started to bake more bread. And bread is a food that you can transport easily as well. And so that maybe shows that was what happened at that time in our evolution. I'm not sure, I'm not giving you a very good answer.
No, it's okay.
Also, I think bread and baking is a source of creativity. So it gives us a major carbohydrate in our diet, and it gives us the potential for making braided bread, or challah is very important in the Jewish Sabbath, made every Friday. We've often had people here who've made Sabbath, the Shabbat, into a special ceremony last year and the year before. I think we did had that on Fridays. Mm-hmm. Samson and different people. So who was here last week? One of our bakers was here last week. So often bread is a food that people make into a special food that is a ritual and helps us to connect with nutrition, with ritual in our life. But I think it is a major part of our diet, isn't it? But it's very important not for one food to not dominate our diet too much, because then what's happened with bread is that you had the Chorley Wood process being introduced in the 70s and bread starting to be mass produced to such an extent that it then has become more unhealthy. So it's only now in the revival of the artisan bread movement and sourdough that we have bread which is being again produced more mindfully and more slowly, and that is healthier again. But once that method got speeded up using the Chorley wood process, and you got these sun-blessed and these big sort of loaves produced very quickly in factories, then people started getting more of these gluten intolerances. So I think it then became not such a healthy thing, but it's still a major part of people's diet.
In Mindful Thoughts for Cooks, you analyze the ideas of simplicity and impatience. How important are they in times of fast food?
Okay, I think often what people actually are after when they go for fast food is simplicity, because it makes their lives simpler, because all they do is get the food and put it in a microwave. But they could get the same simplicity with just cooking something very simple that's actually quite quick. You know, you've got some authors like, say, Simon Rimmer, who did a book, lots of menus you can cook in half an hour. So food doesn't actually have to take very long to cook. And if you cook your own food, you've got a less risk of food poisoning. You're dealing with more whole ingredients and less packaging and more satisfaction. And probably more flavour, more natural flavour, because you can use the whole ingredients yourself. So I think that return to genuine simplicity rather than a false simplicity, which would be just eating mass-produced meals or getting in too much into the habit of it. I would say that that is an instinct for simplicity, but it's getting channeled into just buying fast food. And it's a reflection of our lifestyle that we sometimes, even flats nowadays, bedsitters don't even have an oven in it. I was quite interested when I was researching the heart of the kitchen is the heart of every home chapter in that book. I, you know, discover that some people don't even have an oven, you know, and I couldn't believe it, but it seems to be true that more and more people are not even having their own oven because they're just having a microwave to reheat food. So I think that the joy of cooking is so great, and it's really a need for that simplicity. And so my son's just beginning to cook for himself more, and he likes doing a stir fry. So he, you know, cuts all the ingredients to a small size and puts them in little bowls, and then he cooks them all up together. Very simple and very, you know, tasty and nutritious. Mm-hmm. So if you have eating everything fresh like that. So I would say simplicity. And the nice thing about if you have simplicity on the one hand, then you can also have complexity on the other hand. You can have that variety. So you could have a feast day when you decide you will do something a bit more complicated, but you might also find a way of doing it in a simple way. I was interested, I bought this book, Ottolenghi's Simplicity, and he begins by defining different meanings of simplicity. And one of his definitions of simplicity is how you cook a meal and make it simple. So you're doing lots of the preparation days in advance, so that on the day that you serve up your feast, there isn't too much stress because you've done things in advance. But actually what you're producing is quite complex because it's got lots of different elements that have been produced in different ways using different techniques and different skills of the chef and maybe ingredients from different places. So that maybe is a way you can bring simplicity into your life. And also, if things are quite simple and you've thought about how you're going to do them, then you've got that more enjoyment and you can be more mindful in your cooking. So I think simplicity and mindfulness go together.
And talking about the importance of celebration and thankfulness, here in Schumacher we always eat together and we bless the food before we eat. Why is it important? Why do you think it's important?
I think it just brings our awareness back into the room, that it's a collective experience. In lots of cultures you find this concept, commensality, who people eat with, when they eat with, and eating together is a very important aspect of culture and how we are together. So it brings our attention back to the fact that it's something that we are doing together. It punctuates our day, you know, 1, 2, 3 times a day, and it makes us aware of the food, and it stops us taking it for granted. So not everyone else has the good fortune to have all the food that we have there. Satish often mentions that when he does the blessing, he'll thank the earthworms and he'll say, and we hope that other people in the world may eat as well as we are doing today. So I think that moment of awareness is very important. I wasn't brought up blessing food, really. At my primary school, we'd say a prayer, and I can't even remember what it was, but we'd say a prayer, but we kind of did it rather in a routine way. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a chapter in Mindful Thoughts about the different blessings. And there was another part in that question too, wasn't it? Of celebration. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's nice to acknowledge individuals in terms of birthday cakes, unless they particularly don't want to be, but to acknowledge every individual's contribution to the community, and also to acknowledge seasonal passages. So like this evening we're having the wassail event to on the one hand thank the apple trees for the bounty of the apple harvest last year, but also I think it says it's like just frighten the spirits away so they don't come, and so we have a very bountiful harvest next year. But it just brings our attention to the way to Gaia and to the bounty of the earth. So I think it's very important to have celebrations, to give thanks, and to not take things for granted. It eases our passage through life.
How do you see current movements in defense of change in food, such as slow food, CSAs, and transition movement, and others today?
The importance.
Yeah. I mean, slow food movement had already started before I came to Schumacher College. I think I'd been, you know, hearing about it before I came, and so I was very interested in the slow food movement. And Satish gave me some of the magazines. Unfortunately, not me, but some of our Schumacher chefs went to the slow food gathering, the Arc of Taste. I think they had a huge gathering of chefs from all over the world, and they paid for chefs to go. And a chef and Wayne and Inga, who was our short course program organizer, went to the slow food gathering. And so it's bringing attention back and fighting against this move towards standardization and towards things being too hygienic. And I think slow food, they have like for example, they really try and value diversity and local produce. So it might be a local cheese or a local variety of apples. And if you introduce sort of rules about you can only sell your cheese if you've got a refrigerated van, then there might be lots of small producers of a certain cheese who can no longer take it to market because they haven't got a refrigerated van. So the slow food movement is kind of fighting against all those kind of aspects which threaten the diversity and the culture of food, because lots of these ways of preparing food are very old and embedded in our culture and have been discovered as in small communities as they've grown up. They're often very closely linked to what grows in a particular area, which is, you know, fascinating concept, you know, why one wine from one area tastes very distinct, and it's to do with that exact kind of climate in that microclimate in that area, and same with all foods. So lots of that knowledge would be lost if it wasn't for movements like the slow food movement. And then something like CSAs are very good because they're linking local communities up with small farms. So like at Dartington, we have the school farm CSA in the old school farm that was created for the Dartington Hall School, which was formed when the Elmhursts first bought the Dartington estate in 1925. They wanted to have a school and they built that school, that big school, and it closed about 6 years before Schumacher College started. So in what was their school farm, where children went and did farming, this is now the CSA, the Community Supported Agriculture, run by some different people who make it their business. And the community can go there and help with producing the produce. So they can see, they can have the same experience that we have at Schumacher when we go into the garden. People who are getting their veggie boxes from a CSA can go along and see everything growing, help with the weeding, and help those growers to go on producing food by paying an annual subscription. So I think these local food orientated mechanisms like CSAs are really important to bring back local agriculture and support local agriculture, so we don't become too dependent on importing things and buying industrial produced produce. So CSAs, did you say it mentioned transition as well?
Yeah.
Well, transition, for example, in Totnes, which is where the transition movement started, lots of nut trees were produced. So if you're thinking about building up resilience, which is one of the key things about transition, is you're building up resilience in a community to all the fluctuations and change that might be happening as our society, as oil becomes less, more unstable, and oil begins to decline. So we're less, communities are more resilient, less dependent on oil as it goes into decline. So nut trees are a source of protein. So, you know, planting lots of nut trees in Totnes, and that was a sort of community transition initiative. So I think, you know, getting those kind of initiatives going, you know, people gardening each other's gardens and that kind of thing. So I was very privileged to be asked to make the first a cake for the first year of the transition movement. So that was quite funny. Now it's, you know, at least 10 years or longer since it's been going.
Interesting.
And they wrote it. There was a local first of all, there was Rob's transition handbook, and then there was a transition money, and then I think it was a local transition local food book. So Tamsin Pinkerton wrote that, and she asked me to write a article on preserving. So, you know, that's in transitions, thinking about all these techniques old methods that can help with the local economy, like preserving.
Mm-hmm. And nowadays, how do you think a professional cook or a person who cooks at home could contribute to this, to the transition to a new world, a better world? How the professionals or people that cook at home can?
Well, I think, you know, being aware about how you source your produce, using organic produce where you can, and being aware of what is valuable about organic produce, you know, the fact that you've got animal welfare, I think they've only now begun to produce the first kind of proof about how much better for you organic produce is. A long time they said, well, there's no actual proof that my organic food's any better for you than normal, mass-produced food or industrially produced food. Well, that's maybe not the right expression, but so if you're aware of buying more local produce and with less packaging, so all these things a chef, professional chef or a home chef can do, they could link up with neighbours and all buy produce from something like Essential or Suma together, so they can buy more things in bulk with less packaging, more whole food. So I think that people have got a lot of power power. And also, say, if you're going to a supermarket, you can leave your packaging behind. I think that's one of the things I wrote about it in Mindful Thoughts for Cooks. Mm-hmm. These things I found out about where people just left their packaging behind as a protest against packaging, mm-hmm. saying, you know, actually, we don't want this. And then the supermarkets will stop buying into that way of things happening. And even now people are beginning to say, do you want a bag? Before, you'd automatically be given a bag. And now they're reintroducing charges for plastic bags as a disincentive for buying plastic and paper bags. So you're getting less the sort of culture of being more aware of exploiting the earth's resources is sort of gradually percolating through. But I think as a chef and a cook, you're in a key position to choose your ingredients carefully. And you know, maybe you can show your children, or you can kind of think, now if I'm using a lot of you know, maybe it has a place, takeaway meals up to a point, but you could say, well, I've gone too far that way. Now I'm going to start trying to cook simply, do my own form of fast food. So I'm going to cook some simple meals myself. And then you might also notice the money you save as well. If you're cooking things from scratch, you can support your local CSA and develop a personal connection with a farm as well. So I think you've got a lot of power as a chef to choose your ingredients wisely and enjoy your cooking, be mindful in your cooking, share meals, maybe cook something to give to someone else. If you've got somebody next door who might benefit from some of your bread or something, and maybe they can't cook themselves, you can share. Food is a great way for sharing things. You know, give them some of your jam or something. So,
great.
And in our interviews, we always ask questions about food to watch.
Yeah.
A movie or TV, to eat and to read. What's your suggestion to watch?
I've got two thoughts, because I've just been teaching the Marmalade course, yeah. And I watched Paddington 2. And in it, there's this great scene about marmalade making. It's very funny, but it's not really a film about food, and it's not really very sensible. So I wouldn't really recommend Paddington 2 as a food film, but it has got this scene about marmalade making in the prison, which is very, very funny. And but I would watch one of the Michael Pollan films. I think it's called Cooked, and it's on Netflix. It's a Netflix series, and it's really interesting. And particularly, I thought the one on cheese and dairy, it's got a fascinating part where they show there's this sister called Sister Nuella who makes her cheese she's taught to make cheese in a wooden, a big wooden barrel. And then by a French cheesemaker who's coming to visit. And she teaches this sister how to make this traditional cheese in a wooden barrel. And then the health and safety people come and say, you can't make your cheese in a wooden barrel. You've got to close you down. You can't do it. But she wouldn't take kind of no for an answer. So then she went and studied microbiology and did a degree in microbiology. And then she discovered that there was actually something that was kept in the wall of this wooden barrel that that killed off all the bad things in the cheese and all the microbes. So it was actually more beneficial than cooking, than making cheese in a plastic container. And so she convinced all these health and safety people. So it just is a good demonstration of how things can become too hygiene conscious. But the whole series of Michael Pollan films in that series, Cooked, are really fascinating, you know, about fermentation, about different aspects of the food industry.
Great.
And to eat?
To eat. What do I recommend to eat?
Yeah.
I think, or even just if you want to be healthy, you could just start eating more. Making your own sauerkraut and kimchi, like, you know, Vori does, and eating a little bit every day. So you're kind of potentizing your diet with a bit of something extra healthy. So I think that's what I would say. It's not a whole meal, but it's just a little suggestion.
Great. And to read?
To read.
And your books,
it has to be
course.
About a book about food. Cook, because he's say you could read something like the Omnivore's Dilemma.
Great.
Okay.
Is there anything else that you would like to share that we didn't cover in our questions? Do you think it's important?
I'm trying to think. We've really covered everything, haven't we? Because we've covered how we work at Schumacher College, how people engage with every student who comes here cooks a bit in the morning and then comes and cooks in the evening once a week. So that I think we've sort of touched on that as we've been talking. Mm-hmm. So
if you want to explain more about that, how did you build this routine of the students here, the life in the college and teaching?
Well, I think the college has got a bit of an influence from an ashram. So Satish is one of the founders of Schumacher College, and he's very much grown up in that ashram tradition that you have in India. And then also another influence, there was someone called Brian Nicholson here who'd been at Brockwood Park. And then at Dartington Hall School, you also had this concept of people at Dartington, you know, joining in and doing good work. So that those together were influenced Schumacher College to start, and as we continue, with people joining in with doing some of the basic tasks, whether it's cleaning, gardening, or cooking. So we have that still at the college, and it seems to work really well, that it's a vehicle for people being responsible for their own mess and their own tidiness, and for sharing, for developing teamwork, and for offering something back to the community. So you're also in the role of nurturer when you cook together. So I think that seems to work very well. I hope you agree, because Diago's been doing so much washing up, you might not agree.
Yeah.
Julia, thank you very much for this interview and your generosity for sharing all your experience and the books that you wrote to everybody, and your experience here in Schumacher. It was very pleasant, and we are very grateful. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.